Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 544. In this episode, Scott talks with Jason Scott about archiving digital experiences using emulation.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today we're talking with Jason Scott. He is the creator and the owner of textfiles.com, a very popular website that archives files from historic bulletin board systems. I had a BBS, and I think I was actually mentioned in his 2005 documentary film about BBS. It's called BBS the Documentary. And he also is a historian and archivist. Thanks so much for chatting with me.
Hey, no problem.
I've been a big fan for many, many years because I had a BBS early on. I ran a FidoNet node, and I really feel like the young people today don't appreciate how much amazing software was created before they were born. And it seems like a lot of that software is disappearing. Like, we won't be able to run these things ever again.
Yeah, you know, the thing with software is that it both functions and powers everything that we live with in every single way, but it's also not really been regarded on its own as a piece of artwork or social artifact that we would preserve, like we might preserve an old painting or even an old menu. And I think some of the world is coming around to that now, but in the meantime, we've had, you know, honestly, over 50 years of software going on and over 30 years of what we would think of as the home computer or the personal computer. And so, yeah, there's a lot of history down there of something people don't think of as history.
Yeah. In the past, you know, people will used to respect the URL or the URI. We used to have the phrase, cool URIs don't change. And then the Wayback Machine came along and people take that for granted. The idea that like, well, if that URL's gone, I'll just go to archive.org and they'll have a copy, or I'll go to the Google cache and they'll have a copy. But with software, there's quite a bit of setup to emulate a system, and also a lot of thankless work being done on the part of the, by the writers of the emulators themselves.
Yeah. You know, when people think of software, there's stuff that maybe they don't think of software at all, like the stuff that drives their elevators or stuff that makes traffic lights go. But then there's like the very obvious software, like a paint program or a sound program that you used, or an app that you're using right now that is some sort of game, or maybe it just keeps track of something for you on your phone. And all of those items all are depending on an environment that itself is completely shifting and is running on hardware that will be considered obsolete in anything from 2 years ago to 10 years from now. And that software is something that, as time goes on, has to depend on technologies like emulation to keep running. And emulation, like a lot of things in the world, doesn't just happen. You know, it doesn't just make itself work. And so there are people who, going back over the past 20 years, to be honestly, have tried their best to be able to recreate older computers and computer environments and game environments and electronic environments in your computer, your modern computer, and keep it maintained and accurate. And this is a Sisyphean task in every single way.
Indeed. My first kind of foray was a selfish one. And I think that we'll speak about motivations in a minute, but selfishly, I wanted to use, you know, MAME, the multi-arcade machine emulator, to play games that, so I didn't have to go to the arcade. That's an extremely selfish thing. I wonder what the motivations are on the part of the MAME people. Are they historians and archivists, or do they just want to play games too?
So there's a whole bunch of people who have worked on the MAME project over the years, and they seem to have had a range of things. I've definitely seen people who had a very specific game. Maybe they even own that game, and they've wanted to ensure that that game lives on forever. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that over time, the system could emulate old arcades and old computers, you know, relatively well. And so what they started to focus on was finding similarities between all of these machines so that they would only have to emulate one aspect of machines once and then keep going. And as a result, it quickly moved away from a developer who's doing it for kicks and developers that are trying to focus on a long-term, comprehensive emulation of literally the computer human experience. And so it's actually been rather inspiring to watch them over the course of the last 5 years of this project I've been working on to see how they themselves think of machines. And I always stress, you know, if you search for my name in the code of MAME, you will not find it. I am not a developer. I'm just somebody who works with people towards goals. And, as we'll, I'm sure, go into, my big goal was I wanted emulators to run inside of a browser in a way that enabled you to one click access old software. And to do that, I went with the biggest game in town, literally, which is MAME, because their emulator covers thousands and thousands of arcade games and thousands of computer platforms. And I knew that if we got that running in the browser, all of these other machines would come to life.
Yeah, MAME has become almost like an emulator of emulators. It's like there's a driver that like it has the structure around the emulator, and it allows people to then add on different CPUs and different systems, doesn't it?
It's not. Yeah, one of the things that really fascinates me about watching a mature project like MAME, and MAME has basically roots well into the 90s and has all these different philosophies that have been kind of caked into it over the years. And one of them is that machines are basically collections of parts, which sounds obvious, but what they would do is they would emulate a chip as well as they can, and they would emulate different kinds of machinery as well as they can, and then they would say, well, here's a machine, what is it? Well, it's a set of this chip, and then this small custom part, and so they would be able to build new machines relatively quickly. And so that philosophy means that every time they would do a new version, they might add a pile of new hardware because that new hardware, quote unquote, is using off-the-shelf parts, and they would pull those off-the-shelf parts from within MAME already and then just work on the small amount that's different. It's been kind of rather inspiring to watch as I'll see them emulate a machine that I've never heard of in a million years and suddenly it's working. And they constantly, consistently prefer to have the board, which is also interesting. Like what I've seen when somebody says, hey, we'd like to emulate this, they say, show us the board. Like, please take a large picture of the board of the circuit so that we can look at the circuit, because the circuit is the documentation of how it was really built, as opposed to, say, some manual that implies that it's built this way.
Exactly. The board and its existence is the expression of its intent and the only documentation. It is the fact. It works like this. Whether someone wrote down that they thought it might work like this or was intended to work like this, the fact is it shipped this way, and we will emulate it as it was shipped.
Yeah. So that, to me, has been – it's been kind of amazing to watch them in progress and everything else. I mean, every day that group of developers is doing anywhere between, I've seen as many as 100 and as small as 30 new changes, where they've made changes every day for years on end to improve things, to fix bugs, to make things more flexible. It's been really, I mean, quite inspiring to watch.
I have a MAME machine behind me that I built, like a full-sized arcade that I built from scratch. And what is the relationship, though, between the MAME kind of C and C++ app that we've been running for many, many years, and how did that jump into the browser? Like, how did they compile it to JavaScript? And then is that another project? Is it downstream of MAME?
Sure. So what happened is that, of course, MAME, like I said, was really mature years and years ago. They made a very specific set of design decisions. It's very flexible. You can always find a faster emulator of some platform or set of platforms that's being hand-maintained by one or two people, but you won't have that universal access. So MAME sacrifices a little bit of speed, although to obviously most machines today that wouldn't matter at all, in the name of accuracy and universality. So that system has been in place for quite some time. And when we decided we wanted to work on the idea of putting MAME into a browser, I looked around at what possibilities there were. And we have a number of ways to execute code in a browser. You know, things like Java, people would know about Java, or perhaps some sort of specialized plugin that goes into Chrome or Firefox or another browser that kind of brings up executable code in a small encapsulated piece. But what I fell onto was the fact that quietly, without anybody really jumping into it or anything, JavaScript had matured to the point that it was in pretty much every browser, had an enormous amount of flexibility and ability to do everything from control keyboards and run video and sound to networking even. And it wasn't under control of one person or one entity. A thing like Java, as we saw with something as simple as the Google, quote, Sun, in quotes, lawsuit, was that there were still commercial entities that thought of the Java world as somebody's. But nobody really owned Java, just like nobody really owned HTML. You don't get a cease and desist for using an A anchor from HTML, and you don't get a cease and desist by using JavaScript. And so the JavaScript language has had a couple of advancements over the years. And one of them was that there were a couple companies who had written bridging applications to go from C++ to JavaScript. So you could literally compile JavaScript as the target of a C++ file. Now, this technology was relatively new. There were a couple people who were selling a compiler, but there was also an open source version, and it was called Mscripten, and it was being run by the Mozilla Foundation. And there's a fellow there, Alon Zakai. He's been the day-to-day maintainer of that code for years now. And when we first set out on the project, a number of people came forward. I asked for volunteers, and one of them was Dopefish Justin, who had been working on the MAME project for years, and he was fascinated by this. And there's Vittorio Milano, and there's James Baroncao, and there's a bunch of people who have been kind of drifting into the project and then working endless nights. And they were all fascinated at this project idea because the outcome would be theoretically miraculous. And so when we first started using Mscripten, give you an idea, I mean, you've seen this in many projects, I'm sure. It took us, I think, something on the order of 9 months to make a ColecoVision run at 5% speed inside of a browser. And then within a month, we had 10 machines running at 50%. And then within 2 months, we had 50 machines running at anywhere from 50 to 100%.
Oh, my.
And so it kind of iterated up very quickly, and people would come in, and we would get people who looked at it and said, you know, you're setting this, and that's kind of weird. Or we would hand it back to the Mscripten team or the Firefox team. I mean, over time, I mean, to have a project as large, I mean, the whole point of something like an Mscripten was, oh, you wrote a calculator, or you wrote a database application, or you wrote this small program. Hey, now it's JavaScript. Isn't that great? Everything's wine and roses. And here we were throwing this decade plus old massive project that was meant to do this incredibly complicated thing into a browser and threw them script in. And so the first time I think we did it, it produced 75 megabytes of JavaScript code, and it made Firefox crash, and Chrome thought it was broken. And we caused code changes to Firefox, to Chrome, to Emscripten, and to MAME, because everybody had things they never expected would be important. Like there was code in Firefox, for example, that would do a quick check of a JavaScript program to make sure that it was functional. And we had more than 100,000 lines of code that was in JavaScript, and it would crash Firefox. So Firefox added a thing that said, if it's that big, don't just let it go. And Chrome had a few things where it made calls and it turned out it wasn't compatible and they fixed it and so on. And then MAME itself had a number of approaches that needed a special kind of sound device to work with the web and so on. But when it was all said and done, at one point we had it that it was down to, I want to say, about 8 or 9 megabytes of JavaScript code to do a specific machine emulation. And then under the way that JavaScript works, it actually compresses down to like less than a meg. So for less than a meg, you would have a working Apple II or a working Asteroids machine. So we ended up with this environment, and what ended up happening was when I first started it, there was great skepticism among the MAME team that this was even a good idea. There was skepticism in many areas that this was a good use of resources or time or a solution. And what ended up happening was that last year and into this year, MAME actually absorbed our entire project. So there is now direct support for compiling with JavaScript as a target in MAME, which means that technically the project that I worked on has been 100% obsoleted. That is to say, we don't have to write any code to make MAME compile cleanly into JavaScript, because now MAME recognizes JavaScript as one of its official outputs, along with Macintosh and OS X and Windows and everywhere else. Mm-hmm. So that was a huge step. And one of the side effects of that, of course, is that compiling out to the newest version of MAME, because a new version of MAME comes out every month.
This episode of Hansel Minutes is brought to you by Braintree Payments. Why make payment integration more difficult than it has to be? Braintree's powerful full-stack payment platform allows you to accept nearly any type of payment from any device with one integration. It's flexible to your system's needs, supports most programming languages, so whether you're using Java, Ruby, or Python, you'll always have a range of server-side and client-side SDKs available. Braintree makes payments and your job a whole lot easier. You can learn more at BraintreePayments.com/Hanselman. That's BraintreePayments.com/Hanselman.
The Internet Archive, where I work and where we have this running, can have the newest changes to MAME in our web version within the day of there being improvements. And if somebody makes an improvement immediately to fix a major bug, we can just turn around and have that copy. Whereas previously it was a very, bespoke and bunch of people working together and then dropping, hints to each other, and we would slowly produce the new version. Now it's pretty much automated. And so that's great. To describe to a greater extent what we're talking about here is a philosophy. My goal always had been, the reason why I spent a few years, herding people into this and talking about it was because I realized that, with a lot of the history, the software history, I can sit here and I do and make images of CD-ROMs or image floppies or image, cassette tapes with data on them. And then we would end up with a big pile of data that would have meaning to a vanishingly small number of people who they might say, okay, I want this. I will download it. I will make it work in an emulator. I will analyze it and mm-hmm. everything else. But that's not how people work. And that's not how value is recognized in this history. You know, if somebody said to you, trust me, there's lots of paintings and they're in the warehouse and we have them in boxes and don't worry, they're good. Mm-hmm. People would be like, oh, okay. How do I see the paintings? Oh, by appointment, with a month in warning. People wouldn't give money to museums because they'd say, well, where's the stuff? And what they do is they put the stuff up on the wall. They make sure it's maintained and everything else. And with movies and old, radio shows and old texts, if a person can go to a website and in one click read an old newspaper or read an old magazine, they recognize both the contributions of that magazine and they're able to reference it and use it in their work. They say, hey, look at this. This was noted in this magazine. Here's a link. Or, hey, somebody made something that feels much like an analog to what we're dealing with today 50 years ago. Here's what it looked like. You know, we just become richer as a society and as a group of people who are, you know, working on anything that touches a historical basis. And so I wanted that for software. And so in the same way that you don't even think about the fact that somebody links you to a YouTube video or a Vimeo or something else and you just watch it, I wanted it to be so transparent and seamless that a person would say, huh, somebody made something like this app for the Apple II. Here's what it looked like. And then just linking you and beep, and there's an Apple II running in your browser and what it was like, and you try it. And, you know, in terms of how people in the world regard it, I mean, I can tell you that, you know, thousands and thousands of people are using this software emulator in the browser now in a way ranging from just enjoying old entertainment that they used to play as a kid, you know, in other words, a personal narrative, or they're using it to reference things in classes or their writings or to use as a jumping off point for their own work. And so the fact that it's becoming transparent and that the hard work underneath it is not necessarily at the forefront of people's minds is actually to me an incredible sign of success, because you don't wake up. I mean, you know, there are dozens of tests that the YouTube player does to your browser, to your system when you run it, to make sure it gives you the smoothest experience. It figures out where you are and how your machine runs to give you video that is as smooth as possible and working as well as it can with your network. But you don't, boot up a new Britney Spears video and think, oh, these brave engineers, they're working so hard. Oh my God. Can you imagine how they're able to keep this high definition thing going, even though I'm downloading this in the background? That's amazing. Like I understand that. Just like you don't drive over a bridge and thank the 500 people that make that bridge not fall down. And the fact that you're not taken out of the experience and that it boots up and that you're looking at a computer or an old arcade game or an old computer in the browser is just great to me. So it's nice because in the last couple of years, we've really had a success in that area. And so it's really, it's not perfect. And we certainly can whip out tests that show you how imperfect it is. But when it works, it's just in the background. The most prominent one right now is the number one item that people go to the Internet Archive for the software reason. And by often go, I mean every 8 seconds, a new one boots up is Oregon Trail for DOS. And it's used by schools.
That's a classic.
Yeah, it's an absolute classic. It's timeless. It's literally as timeless as Washington crossing the Delaware or a Beethoven symphony in terms of how beautifully it brings all of these historical aspects of the Oregon Trail and the difficulty of using, oxen and a big pile of wood dragging it across a state, combined with lessons in economics and resource management and history. I mean, you know, it's this brilliant piece of work, and it it's still in use. Like, people are booting it up from schools in browsers and having people play these games because it's really, really functional. I mean, yeah, people will boot up a Pac-Man clone or an arcade machine clone and so on. But yeah, educational software in some ways is very evergreen. Like, we haven't changed how we understand how fractions work. So an educational program that was written by experts and is of good quality and time is shown to be good quality, still works. You know, plunk a kid in front of it and they're going to learn. And the fact that it just functions that way is to me just really amazing. And so it's become interwoven into a certain amount of the fabric of life at this point.
You said in 2011, when you kicked off this idea, when you said, I want to help port Mess and MAME to JavaScript, that you had basically were moving from dealing with artifacts to dealing with experiences. Like, you've collected all these text files and collected all these artifacts and these graphics and all these things, but they are artifacts, as opposed to saying, here is an experience. And you have this great sentence here where you say, you want to take someone from, I wonder what it was like to play Choplifter, to, wow, I'm playing Choplifter. And 5 years later, that has happened. It's exactly that.
Right.
I show my kids the game. I give them the URL. They go to it. And it's not that they're watching a video. It's not that they're looking at screenshots. They are experiencing it. And you're even going so far to make it look the way it was. I'm looking at a demo here of CRT effects.
Sure.
What's going on here?
Okay. So one of the great things about mankind is, like Douglas Adams said, you know, we quickly go from, you know, how do I eat, to what is eating, to where do we eat? And the fact is that people go, hey, this is working in my browser. What an amazing thing, to, well, I remember it a little differently. And I don't think this is exactly how it was. You should really fix that, you know, like it's a bug. And mm-hmm. in the same way that you might, you know, play an old movie and you'll have it cropped or time stretched or the sound isn't what you remember, we quickly run into the greatest problem that every preservation project has, which is bringing back not just the fact of a thing and enough of its attributes for you to go, yes, that's true. The woman in the painting has one head. There's a dog in the painting, to what is it like to stand in a gallery with this painting and how can I reproduce that experience? Because that's part of what the painting's purpose was to wow you. And with computers and video games, if you look back at that experience, it's both digital, you know, digital data, but there's actually a lot of analog experience as well. We end up with things like, you know, putting a disk into a disk drive, hearing the grind of a disk as it would boot up different parts of the floppy during mm-hmm. the game. People would tell me, you know, they would play an old game on an old computer with a floppy disk in the machine, and they would move down a dungeon, and at one point they'd turn a corner and they would hear the disk drive light turn on and grind, and they would reach over reflexively and pop the door open because they knew it was about to write a death. And so they totally knew true. That they could do this. They could avoid a death by stopping the machine from writing anything to the floppy. And that experience is not vital. I mean, for some people, just knowing that there was a game that had dungeons and death and it was on a computer is sufficient. But for people who then try to compare it to how it really was, things like sound and video and performance need, ironically, much more work to emulate the flaws and strangeness of the past. And so one of those projects that was started by some people involved with MAME was to start emulating the way that monitors really worked pre-LCD screen, pre-flat screen, you know, when tubes were the order of the day inside of a monitor, and it was this beam that magnets were manipulating to make phosphorus glow on a screen so that a beam aimed at your eye was being stopped by this painted curved glass that would glow and sometimes had a beam that would be different colors or actually color on the glass to be able to make
it. Right, vector games.
Right, vector games and RCA televisions, actually. And they would bring out color, but at a cost of fidelity. And mm-hmm. of course, I mean, you know, we start out with something as simple as, you know, UHF and VHF signals, and then we started moving to conversion that would kind of send an ersatz signal to a television. You would have to actually, you know, screw in wires in the back to make your video game use the television, to changes to format with things like S-Video, which is now on its way, well, not even just on its way out. It's out the door. It's down the street. It's gone. And then what we now have with HDMI and other formats. And the fidelity of how they put these things together was calculated into the software. The most classic example, and he's more than happy to tell you about this, is David Crane, who did Pitfall and 100 other games for Activision and many other companies. When he was working on video games in the early 80s, his characters on the screen calculated a certain amount of fuzziness built into the beam so that he would leave a black mark or a black line with no light on it, because he knew the line above and below would blend in that small gap. And when he wanted a quote-unquote hard line, he would use between two or three black lines to ensure that the beam didn't overflow. But he was trying for a very smooth and soft experience. Fast forward, and now people are playing these old games, and they look like Lego bricks because we don't have that anymore. I mean, everybody wants super fidelity. You want to be able to have a 75 dot per inch monitor. And again, you know, dialing it back, having Pitfall in your window in a second after you click a URL is miraculous and now commonplace. But there are going to be iterative improvements to say, okay, yes, we did it. Everyone gets a cake, but wait a minute. We actually had this attribute. We would have slightly fuzzy screens. We would have screens that bled color when the beam stopped running. You know, the phosphorus doesn't just, you know, shut off in 2 seconds. It would do a small afterglow, and it would actually be possible to burn in if you left the thing on for too long. And to emulate all of that is now where we're headed. And it's much more processor intensive. It's much more involved. Certainly on certain machines, the example that we put up, I took an old bootleg, or it wasn't so much a bootleg as kind of an alternate version of Donkey Kong called Crazy Kong. And it has its own interesting, you know, story. And we put up a version of it on the Internet Archive just to enable you to kind of experience a kind of subtle, weird video artifacting of CRTs in 1982, which MAME does. And again, if you have a slower machine, it runs much slower now, because now it's doing a whole layer of calculation. And I've run tests with people. Not everyone sees it, which may be the greatest success of all, right? But for some people, they're like, yeah, what? Yeah. Like, it's just not in their head.
Yeah.
You know, the same way an audiophile might say, I can hear the difference between this is a vinyl record and this is a cassette off of the master tape. In the same way, you can have people whose eyes just kind of bring in like, yep, that's an old video game. And people who go, what, how is it ghosting the character? He's fading as he runs by subtly. That's amazing. And they'll see it. So that's, you know, that's one piece of it. And like I made a reference to, MAME is now working very hard to emulate the sounds of a floppy drive that will become a slider. I'll be sure to add that when it's mature enough, but basically there's been work to literally sample a disk drive engine and read process so that an accurate portrayal of what that disk drive sounded like next to your machine can be included optionally. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of work that, like, you know, I mean, I've been told there's like six people who do silk painting restoring in the world, and everybody who apprentices under them has to apprentice for 15 or 20 years before they get their own shot at it. And there is a very small amount of people, and I support and care about them very much, who are focused on this kind of level, because this is work that is, I would say, relatively thankless. Not in a bad way, just relatively thankless.
Yeah, yeah. So as we reach the end of our time here, let me ask you this.
Sure.
The call to action to the audience isn't just go and experience, but it's also to appreciate. And let me ask you this. How do we support you? How do we support TextFiles? How do we support archive.org? This isn't run by the government, right? How do you all get money, and how can we give you money?
So the Internet Archive is a nonprofit library that people know of as the Wayback Machine, and more people know about for the software and obviously the books and movies and music and all the other things that it hosts. And it's at archive.org, and there's an archive.org/donate. And that's fine. I would love for people to contribute in ways that help financially with such a nonprofit. But beyond that, if you have a audience who have technical expertise or who have influence mm-hmm. in the realm of understanding, you know, our computer history or presenting it, I would say, you know, a project like MAME, and there's other ones, really are depending on really technically skilled people who are also working basically for free and who are constantly on the move to try to make sure that some record of old software and old hardware persists. And they have, like any large scale project, you know, rules for adding code. So if you're a coder, if you're doing work in MAME and you're helping, it's going to be reflected in code that thousands and thousands of people will use around the world. So there's a reward there, and contributing your expertise would not just be you're helping some nerd play an old Atari game. I mean, you are literally affecting computer history and online and digital history by doing this. But beyond that, people who have old hardware, old materials, who are wondering about, like, does anyone care? We care. And I'm not afraid to give my email out, jscott@archive.org. I love hearing from people who are like, my favorite letters are, I don't know if this is of interest, but, because it almost always is of interest, you know, and people saying, I don't even know where to begin with this. I have old stuff. Maybe it's useful. Maybe it's not. And just that mental jump from, like, if you went up into your attic and there were 10 old paintings there and they looked really old and they were wrapped really nicely, you wouldn't be like, oh no, what do you think? Can I throw this out? Do I keep? Like, you would say, man, I better call a local museum. And if you've got a relative or yourself and you've got some old software, you may be the last person to have that software or any record of that old software. And contacting us to say, look, I've got some stuff, would be wonderful. That, you know, finance always helpful. We do fundraising drives, and MAME has fundraising drives to help acquire rare equipment when it needs to be purchased. But, you know, a technical expertise and an emotional and supportive expertise, that's where we really, really, I think this thing needs love. People need to know, and people need to help it, and people need to encourage it in just a, this is a valid, wonderful thing that needs to be done culturally for the way the world has been for the last half century. As important as making sure that an old film is still playable and making sure that an old car, still runs, this is still really vital and needs to be there for future generations.
Well, I think definitely the work that you're doing is absolutely vital, and I am in awe of the corpus of information that has been collected since you were 9 years old. And I think I speak on behalf of the audience that we appreciate you, we appreciate Text Files, and we appreciate archive.org. And thanks so much for chatting with me today.
Hey, thank you.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.